Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan urged world financial leaders to reduce poverty and help all people benefit from the global technology revolution in a speech that echoed the message of protesters who disrupted weekend meetings in Washington. Annan's audience yesterday included finance ministers, IMF acting managing director Stanley Fischer, and World Bank managing director Sven Sandstrom, all fresh from the meetings of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. The ministers and bankers renewed their pledges to hasten debt relief for the poorest countries, but Annan urged them to listen to the demonstrators and do more. Accusing the government of being soft on asylum seekers, Britain's opposition conservatives have proposed that applicants be put in detention centers when they arrive to separate justified claims from bogus ones. The Labour government, hoping to deter asylum seekers last month, cut cash grants previously paid to them. It also said more would be forced to settle outside London and announced heavy fines for truckers caught smuggling illegal immigrants. This news from Tennessee. It has carried out its first execution in 40 years. 44-year-old Robert Glenn Coe was given a deadly dose of drugs early this morning. He was put to death for the rape and murder of an 8-year-old girl in 1979. Coe's attorneys had won a stay late last night, but the state Supreme Court overturned that ruling just after midnight. The parents of Amadou Diallo have filed an $81 million lawsuit against the city of New York and the four officers who fatally shot their son. They're asking for $40 million for pain and suffering and $1 million for each of the 41 bullets fired at Amadou. 19 of the 41 shots struck Diallo as he stood in the vestibule of his Bronx apartment building. The West African immigrant was unarmed. The suit claims the officers, quote, intentionally, wantonly, recklessly, and maliciously opened fire. It also claims the shooting resulted from aggressive racial profiling practices sanctioned by police. The four white officers were acquitted of murder charges in February. And this news from Los Angeles. At least 71 more criminal convictions, all of them misdemeanors, may be overturned because of the ongoing scandal within the Los Angeles Police Department. This according to the Los Angeles Times. The cases, which involve a number of drug and weapons possession arrests, are in addition to 99 felony convictions that authorities have already identified as being tainted by allegations of police conduct at the LAPD's Rampart Station. So far, 60 felony convictions have been reversed, including 10 on Thursday, amid allegations that anti-gang officers in Los Angeles's poor, largely minority Rampart section framed, beat, and sometimes shot innocent people, then fabricated evidence and lied in court to win convictions. This news from Providence, Rhode Island. Two white police officers have been cleared in the death of a black off-duty officer that they mistook for a suspect. The shooting sparked city protests by African Americans and a federal civil rights probe. A grand jury spent about 2 months reviewing the conduct of the officers in the death of Sergeant Cornell Young Jr. before deciding no criminal charges were warranted. One of the men who shot Cornell Young was a classmate of his at the police academy. This news from Colorado. Just days before the one-year anniversary of the Columbine High School shootings in Colorado, the parents of one of the victims have sued the sheriff and several deputies. They contend Jefferson County authorities ignored warnings about the teenage gunmen that could have prevented the killings from taking place. The suit by Michael and Vonda Scholes was the first of several expected to be filed by Thursday. That's the one-year anniversary of the attack that left 15 dead, including Scholes' son Isaiah and the two student gunmen. These victims' families have 1 year to sue under the statute of limitations. The Scholes are African American. The Miranda warning is on trial in the Supreme Court. The justices will hear arguments today on whether police still must tell criminal suspects they have the right to remain silent before questioning them. Such warnings have been required ever since the Supreme Court's landmark 1966 decision in Miranda versus Arizona. But a federal appeals court last year ruled that incriminating statements need not be excluded at a trial just because the warning wasn't given. A long-ignored 1968 law was cited. Prosecutors and police generally oppose Miranda, while criminal defense lawyers and civil libertarians argue for its necessity. A decision by the High Court is expected in late June. And that's some of the news at this hour. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Yesterday, the UN Security Council warned countries that violated sanctions against Angola's UNITA rebels that they may face UN penalties for having helped the rebels to restart their war with the government. In a unanimously adopted resolution, the council gave the accused 6 months to challenge allegations in an independent report on embargo breaches and demonstrate their adherence to sanctions before the council considers taking action. While vague and lacking actual punitive measures, the resolution marked the first time the council has formally suggested applying so-called secondary sanctions on countries or individuals that violate UN embargoes. In a groundbreaking report issued last month, an independent panel listed the violations of the United Nations fuel and arms embargo and ban on rebel diamond sales that enabled UNITA to restart a 20-year-old war with the government in December of 1998, shattering a UN-brokered ceasefire. Meanwhile, in Sierra Leone, rebel fighters control the diamond mines. The 6,500 UN peacekeepers now stationed there are expected to receive 5,000 reinforcements by June. They're trying to safeguard the peace accord signed by Revolutionary United Front rebels and Sierra Leone government officials last July. But peace is far from secure. Rebels still rape, rob, and kill defenseless villagers in many parts of the country, according to human rights groups. And they've refused to disarm. In the absence of jobs, they make money mining diamonds and smuggling them out of the country. We're joined right now by a number of people who are working on this issue. David Maloney is the Canadian Foreign Service officer, on leave now, and president of the International Peace Academy, an independent nonpartisan organization dedicated to promoting the peaceful settlement of armed conflicts between and within states. His organization has just released a book called The Sanctions Decade, Assessing UN Strategies in the 1990s. Ian Smiley is associate with the Thomas J. Watson Institute at Brown University. He has 30 years of international development experience and is a recent partner by Partnership Africa-Canada called The Heart of the Matter, Sierra Leone, Diamonds, and Human Security. Lansana Gberi is a doctoral student at the University of Toronto. He also collaborated on the report on diamonds in Sierra Leone. He worked as an investigative journalist in Sierra Leone between 1990 and 96 and has written extensively on the country's history and politics. Today, we'll talk about corporations, diamonds, and Sierra Leone. David Malone, why don't we start with you, Canadian Foreign Service officer. Tell us about the connection between the corporations and diamonds in Sierra Leone.
Well, there are different types of corporations involved in the diamonds trade. The trade is dominated by the De Beers Company based in South Africa, but with interests that are fairly widespread. There are a number of intermediaries in various countries around Africa and elsewhere. And there are, of course, locally a number of actors, often international actors, who are engaged in the mining of diamonds, which is in effect the extraction of them often. So there's a variety of actors, but somewhat less in the diamonds trade and in the oil trade than in many other areas of extractive industries. So they're easier to target, in other words.
Ian Smiley of the Institute at Brown University, associate with Thomas J. Watson Institute. Talk about how the corporations work with the rebels in Sierra Leone.
Well, there's different levels of let's say, collaboration and different levels of corporation. I mean, when we talk corporation and diamonds, we often think of De Beers because they're the biggest. But there are, on the fringes of the diamond industry, all kinds of sharks and bottom feeders as well. And that tends to be the norm in Sierra Leone. You get a lot of organizations, small junior mining companies, and so on, that are in there looking for a chance. And in fact, many of them, we've often said, many of them are mining the stock market more than they're mining diamonds. A part of the diamond industry that isn't very well known. We talk a lot about De Beers, but 70% of the world's diamonds go through De Beers. But De Beers sells them, and a huge amount of the diamonds go to Antwerp. So 70% of the world's diamonds also go through Antwerp. And there you have hundreds of smaller dealers, cutters, traders, and all the rest of it. And they are probably the biggest part of the problem after the diamonds get out of Sierra Leone.
How aware is the rest of the world about this corporate connection? And what do you think has to be done about it?
Well, I don't think people are aware at all. I mean, diamonds are a symbol of love and purity. De Beers advertises extensively. Last year, their advertising budget was $200 million. De Beers doesn't actually sell any diamonds to the public. It's really just advertising for the people who do sell diamonds. Our concern about Sierra Leone is that the diamonds have been used to pay for the war. Diamonds are being smuggled out of Sierra Leone at an alarming rate. Last year, the government said that there were only 8,500 carats exported officially from Sierra Leone. Our guess is that at least 500,000, maybe 1 million carats went out through Liberia. They went to Liberia. They were used to buy weapons, which went back into Sierra Leone and have fueled the war. Probably something like 10% of the world's diamonds are stolen. 40% of the diamonds coming out of Russia are stolen. 7% of South African diamonds are stolen. Practically all of Sierra Leone's diamonds are stolen. All of these go into, let's call them fencing nations like Liberia, and they're used to buy guns. They're used to launder drug money. They're very dangerous. And so people buying diamonds, if you go into a jewelry store to buy a diamond, you don't know where it's come from. Let's say 9 out of 10 are clean, but you really don't know where the 10th one came from. The 10th one probably comes out of a war situation and has been used to buy guns and fuel war in some of these countries.
Lansana Gberi, what do you think is the most important issue to understand about what's happening in Sierra Leone and the trade that's financing the war, the diamond trade?
I think the most important issue is the connection with the Liberian bandits. The government in Liberia is certainly very complicit in the whole carnage in Sierra Leone. And the connection must be made to the diamond industry because the Liberian government is certainly interested in looting Sierra Leone's diamond world. These diamonds pass through the Liberian government, and there are all kinds of shady dealers, all kinds of arms dealers in Liberia, even drug dealers, who are there and who launder drug money and get the diamonds, which are, well, supposed to be relatively very clean, and they are exported from Liberia into places like Belgium, as Ian has already stated. So I think the real issue about the Sierra Leone war is that resources, especially diamond resources, which should have been used to develop the nation, is being used to kill little babies, cut off their hands, and destroy a whole future for a nation of 4.5 million people.
You have De Beers purchasing the majority of all diamonds produced, controlling 2/3 of the world's diamonds. In 98, the market worth $6.7 billion. A company directly involved in Sierra Leone until the 80s. It maintains a trading company in Liberia and an office in Guinea. Both countries produce few diamonds. Liberia is the transit point for the smuggled Sierra Leonean diamonds. And the company says it doesn't purchase Sierra Leonean diamonds, but it's impossible that they're not purchasing these smuggled diamonds. So what do you recommend? Let's put that question to David Malone, Canadian Foreign Service officer and president of the International Peace Academy.
Well, actually, I agree with everything Lansana and Ian have said so far. It's a rather technical question you're raising, and I'd rather it was directed at them because you're more likely to get a competent response.
David Malone.
It's very complicated. De Beers, I mean, the diamond industry is almost medieval in the sense that one company controls 70% of the world's production of diamonds. And you said $6.7 billion. That's $6.7 billion worth of rough diamonds. By the time those diamonds turn into jewelry, that's over $50 billion a year. It's a huge industry. And De Beers is obviously at the center of it. Partly in reaction to our report, De Beers has said that they will not buy any conflict diamonds. They will only buy diamonds in future from their own mines, of course. They have a huge number of mines themselves, and from legitimate companies in countries like Canada and Russia and Namibia and Botswana. They've said they won't buy any diamonds that have any shadow on them. The problem is, how do we know what they're buying? How do we know where the diamonds come from? They haven't said how they're going to explain this. It's going to be very important. One of our recommendations was that there should be an international body looking at the diamond industry as a whole. There should be something that, it could have industry representation in it, but it should have government law enforcement agencies and others involved. Diamonds are a huge export from Australia, from Russia, from a lot of developing countries like South Africa, from Canada and so on. This is a global problem. It isn't just Angola and Sierra Leone. The rot at the edges of the diamond industry is huge, and it really needs some kind of international oversight, not just one company.
Lansana Gbiri, do you think that De Beers should be sanctioned?
Well, we in our report, we went very light on De Beers because we thought, well, as much as they are part of the problem, they could also be part of the solution. You know, they are very strong. The fact that they control about 70% of the world's diamonds give them enough leverage over the whole diamond industry. So we've been trying to see whether we can convince them to reform the system, to be more active in trying to get interested in areas that have been destroyed by the diamonds.
To say the least, De Beers has quite a history going, looking at South Africa during apartheid and the profits it made off of the South African black miners.
Oh, certainly. I mean, they have obviously a very notorious history in that sense, but they also have some positive history in the sense that when they were operating in Sierra Leone, at least, the diamond industry was fairly stable. But the moment they pull out, and when they pull out, well, they have an interest, obviously, in mopping up diamond supplies so as to keep the prices stable. So they might have been dealing in several ways with smuggled diamonds from all these countries, especially Sierra Leone. But in order to we thought that it's probably worthy to encourage them to open an office in Freetown in order, you know, to come out openly and deal openly so that they may undercut the smugglers and all the shady dealers. I mean, the real problem now is all these small companies, the bottom feeders, as Ian said, who are all over the place, and they are supplying guns in exchange for diamonds. So maybe a more open, a more transparent De Beers can help solve the problem in a way.
Ian Smiley, last comment as we wrap up.
I wanted to talk a little bit about, for a moment, just about the Belgian connection in Liberia. Over the last 5 years, Liberia, which has a very, very small amount of diamonds of its own, never exported more than 100,000 carats. Over the last 5 years, Liberia has exported over 30 million carats of diamonds openly to Belgium. The Belgian government, the Belgian industry has looked the other way. They know these are stolen diamonds, and they have looked the other way. The Belgian government needs to get control of the Belgian industry as well. The Belgian industry is seriously complicit in the theft of diamonds, not just from Sierra Leone, but from Angola as well.
And Belgium's history in Africa, going back to King Leopold in the Congo.
Oh, yeah, very, very notorious, too. You know, I mean, they caused so much destruction in the Congo in the 19th century.
Can you talk about the symbolism of the hands?
Yeah, the symbolism of cutting off the hands of African workers, where people who were using this as a tactics to intimidate the African workers. I mean, there was a kind of very sustained slavery going on in the Belgium Congo. And some people are now speculating that, in fact, the RAF may have learned the tactics of cutting off the hands of children from the Belgian. Fode Sankoh, as you know, was a member of the UN peacekeeping force in the Congo in the early 60s. So he might have had stories of the Belgian cutting off the hands of people, and he might have thought that this tactics was very, very effective. And he's used it so effectively. He says, don't vote. He cuts off the hands of a few people. People are intimidated, they won't vote. He says, okay, don't harvest your farms, cuts off the hands of a few peasants, and people run away.
So we have to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, I have one last question. And do you see this issue of De Beers and in Sierra Leone, or taking the smuggled diamonds of Sierra Leone and bringing them to Belgium, to the rest of the world. Do you see it connected in any way to the uprising we're seeing in this country against corporate globalization? You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Our guest has been David Malone, Canadian Foreign Minister, Officer and President of the International Peace Academy. We thank you for being with us. The book just released by his organization, The Sanctions Decade, Assessing UN Strategies in the 90s. We'll come back for a minute with Ian Smiley of Brown University and Lansana Bieri, a student at University of Toronto from Sierra Leone. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we talk about a new report just out looking at Sierra Leone, diamonds, De Beers, Belgium, and Liberia. We're going to go to the sounds of the battle after Seattle in just a minute. But as we lead into it, I wanted to ask this question about the massive uprisings we're seeing now in the United States, from Seattle in November, December, to Washington, D.C. over this past weekend, that are looking at the connections between Western countries, corporations, exploitation of developing countries, particularly in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. What connection do you see? Ian Smiley and then Lansana Bieri, Ian Smiley of Brown University.
Well, our contention is that the diamonds are fueling war. A lot of the diamond industry is clean, but 10% is not clean. It's got blood all over it. And I think what the average consumer should worry about is those 10%, 10% of the diamonds. If you're going to buy a diamond ring for an engagement or wedding, ask the jeweler where the diamond comes from. He'll probably tell you he doesn't know. Don't take that at face value. Insist that you have to know where the diamond comes from. Go somewhere else if he can't tell you. Sooner or later, they will have to track the diamonds back and find out which ones are clean and which are dirty.
And Lansana Bieri of Sierra Leone.
Oh, just to add that the unrestrained nature of this so-called globalization, in which we are seeing big corporations operating in a very, very unethical way in several African and other third world countries, reminds one of the 18th and the 17th century era of mercantilism. You had whole corporations using mercenaries to ravage areas that are very marginal to the world economy. And it's the same thing happening all over again. Most of these corporations are aligned to, they have mercenaries who are operating under them. And they are simply exploiting resources in areas that are so far away from bigger Western economies. They operate almost as a law unto themselves. So I think the kind of consciousness which we saw at Seattle and other places it reflects this kind of unease about the big power of big corporations all over the world.
If people want to get a hold of your report, Partnership Africa Canada, called The Heart of the Matter, Sierra Leone Diamonds and Human Security, where can they call or go on the web?
I think the best place to go is to the Sierra Leone web. You can get it at sierra-leone.org. You'll find it under documents.
And that's Ian Smiley of Brown University, 30 years of international development experience. Lansana Bieri, a doctoral student at the University of Toronto and research associate at the Laurier Center for Military Strategic and Disarmament Studies, who collaborated on that report, The Heart of the Matter, Sierra Leone Diamonds and Human Security. As we move in now to our sounds of the street from the battle after Seattle, over the last weekend, actually, in a buildup of the last few weeks in Washington, D.C., Tens of thousands of people took to the streets. They were protesting the prison industrial complex in this country. They were protesting the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. These two international financial institutions were having major meetings in Washington. The protesters hoped to close those meetings. While they didn't succeed in doing that, they did succeed in being heard around the world and making that link of corporate globalization and the critique of it from Seattle and the successful closing of the millennium round of the World Trade Organization to Washington, D.C. They say next they're taking their protests to Los Angeles, to the Democratic Convention, and to Philadelphia, the Republican Convention, and they're taking these protests to shareholder meetings around the world. This is the sounds of Seattle, the sounds of the battle after Seattle.
This is what democracy sounds like. This is what democracy sounds like. This is what democracy sounds like. This is what democracy sounds like.
They just pushed down a female protester onto the ground. They're pushing her. They're hitting her. They're hitting her. Pushing into the street. They're pushing into the street with a baton. What's the badge number? Get the badge number.
Those people who would decide that they're going to take the law into their own hands in different ways,
right.
Then we have an obligation to suppress that. Only to suppress it. You'll notice that we're not still up there beating them.
IMF, what do you say?
How many kids did you kill today?
IMF,
what do you say?
How many kids did you kill today?
IMF,
what do you say?
How many kids did you kill today?
We blocked off, successfully blocked off, and kept delegates from going into down three entrances into Lafayette Park.
One cluster of the activists with the Mobilization for Global Justice have taken control of the intersection peacefully by locking themselves together.
I'm here because I passionately believe that global capitalism is destroying our planet and it's destroying communities.
People of the South, kick the World Bank out! People of the South, kick the World Bank out! People of the South, kick the World Bank out!
We're here downtown Washington, D.C., asserting some people power, showing that regular people can turn around history.
D.C. quit it!
Pretty tense, but it's a sunny day and revolution is in the air.
We're the billionaires for Bush or Gore. Doesn't really matter. We've bought them both.
We believe that economic inequality is not growing fast enough, and that's why we say more bank, less world, more bank, less world, more bank, less world.
World Bank is not too good for the farmers. Farmers are the poorest people all over the world. And the land is, people borrow, forget a little bit of money, and they are taking it away from them.
There was a bus of police in riot gear that pulled up to one of the intersections that was barricaded, and police jumped out in full riot gear with the batons raised. They did not say one word to one protester. They did not ask anyone to clear the area. They just charged at people and began swinging their batons and hitting people. They hit one gentleman in the face, broke his nose. They hit another woman and pushed her over people. There was not a word said by the police to the protesters. No one asked to clear the area. No one under arrest. Nothing. They just started beating people with their batons.
Sitting in the middle of an intersection, getting ready to block whoever may come through here. There's many protesters sitting down here. It appears that we'll be tear gassed. Who knows, maybe possible arrest. Everyone's staying calm. Everyone's been instructed to go to the sides for medics. Everyone, unity is very strong, stronger than ever, and there's no way they're going to defeat us.
I'm here with Community Television of Santa Cruz County, just covering it for a show called Voices from the Village, as well as just shooting some of my own footage to combine with WTO footage to, you know, document this, to bear witness, to document what's going on and the injustices that are happening here.
Singrauli is a city in India where the World Bank is sponsored, paid for
power plant that's putting toxic ash throughout those neighborhoods. It's yet another project that the World Bank has funded.
I'm interviewing an IMF official. How do you expect me to write a book about the IMF if I don't interview people who are involved in running the IMF? I have an appointment with him now.
Sorry.
Okay, so you consider blocking a legitimate journalist with the Washington Post?
No one goes from, in and no one goes out.
Okay. Well, just so you understand what you're doing, I'm going there to write a book about the IMF.
Someone might question the legitimacy of Washington Post Press anyway, as corporate owned.
The stupidity of your statement is reflected in the stupidity of what you're saying.
We're out here to protest the policy of the IMF and the World Bank.
And why aren't you wearing a shirt?
Symbolic of all of the stripping away of natural resources and economic growth and power of people around the world.
What have you written across your chest and back?
I believe it says the IMF takes the shirt off my back.
What's your name and where are you from?
Samantha McAllister from Seattle.
What's your name?
My name's Chloe.
And where are you from?
From Massachusetts.
And what happened?
Well, we were standing here just like this, and a cop comes up, and I thought he was going to say something, and he just tried to push his way through. And when he couldn't get through, he took out his nightstick and he just kind of hit me with it. That's pretty much it.
How old are you?
17.
Did he say anything before he hit you?
No, he didn't say anything to me at any time.
We're guerrilla gardeners. We're gardening in solidarity with Central American farmers who are losing their land to international debt.
Where are you? Where are we located right now?
We're located in Washington, D.C., right in front of the White House. We are planting squash and organic carrots. Because we're taking back the people's land that the people deserve, not the government bureaucrats and the international loan sharks.
So you are growing, you are planting organic vegetables in Lafayette Park?
Correct. We can see the White House right in front of us, and we're very proud to be taking back this land for the people, and hopefully sometime this fall we'll be harvesting squash and carrots around the first frost, if all goes well.
Yes, I'm Walden Bello. I'm the Executive Director of Focus on the Global South, and I've been in Thailand. And I've come here to join the protests. We've been working at this issue for 20 years, and it's great that there are thousands here now who are rallying to demand the shutting down of the World Bank and the IMF.
Why? Why do you think it's so important to completely shut them down?
Well, I think one is for today, I think it's very important symbolic event to shut down the bank and the fund, because their normal routine of operations has been very damaging for countries in the South. But beyond that, I think that that a lot of people here who have looked at the two institutions are for permanently abolishing them, because despite different efforts at rhetorical reform, the basic World Bank and IMF strategies that promote stagnation and are anti-growth and are poverty creating are still the same. So these two institutions feel rather besieged at this point, because the Meltzer Commission, which was a commission that was commissioned by the US Congress to look at the performance of the IMF and the World Bank, now has endorsed many of the critiques that many progressives had been making about these two institutions. And that commission has asked for downsizing the bank and the fund at a time that the bank and the fund has lost a lot of legitimacy among quite, large numbers of people in the world. So these two institutions are now fighting for their life. And it is very important to be able to underline the fact that it's very hard to reform them. It would be easier, in fact, to establish other institutions built on new principles in their place. the core of the strategy is still the core of liberalization, deregulation, and privatization. That's the core of the strategy. This is the problem because, on the one hand, you have a great PR exercise by Jim Wolfensohn, the president of the bank, but in reality, there's been no change. So, and this is the same way that McNamara said that he was reforming the bank along anti-poverty lines, basic needs in the 1970s. So you now have a monolithic Jurassic institution that's 10,000 employees, the most highly paid in the world, really not effectively doing its job. My sense is that you have the problem really is in the paradigm of development that the bank has, as well as the institutional direction that the bank has followed, as well as the reason that it's very sensitive and very responsive to the needs of the G7 countries. So for all of those reasons, it would not do to reform this institution. If you really want to end poverty, I think you've got to get the bank out of it, devolve the anti-poverty function to local and regional agencies, including some of the regional banks, because they have a far more effective way of addressing poverty rather than a distant institution in Washington.
This is a group of puppeteers that are from all over the country, and they call themselves the Puppetistas and other names, but this is the structural adjustment pulverizer. It's eating up landscapes and communities all around. And so we feed these communities into the machine in the front, and what you see that comes out is
suburban sprawl
and strip malls and factories, disrupted communities.
What are you particularly dressed up as?
Well, I'm a chainsaw. I help cut down all the forests.
Yeah, my name's Nagini Prasad. We're here for two reasons. One is we want to get Ogden out of Maheshwar Dam in the Narmada Valley of India. And the other thing is we want to bring justice to the victims of Union Carbide's disaster in Bhopal. They committed genocide, corporate manslaughter, and we want to give them justice. We want to bring Warren Anderson to justice. And that's why we're here today, to say, save the Narmada, get Ogden out of India, and justice to the victims of Union Carbide.
What's Ogden?
Ogden Corporation is a U.S.-based corporation that has many businesses in power, entertainment, waste energy. They currently have a 49% equity stake in the Maheshwar Dam in India. And this was recent Bill Clinton's visit to India. And we basically want them out of Maheshwar.
Where is Maheshwar and what's the problem with it?
Maheshwar Dam is in the state of Madhya Pradesh in India, upstream from the more well-known Sardar Sarovar Dam, which was financed by the World Bank. The problem is that it will displace about 35,000 people who live along the river, whose livelihoods and lives are affected by the dam. And there is no environmental, to my knowledge, there's no environmental assessment. And Ogden, I think, visited the dam site once. I think that was just either just before or just after the signing of the agreement, despite repeated written requests by the people of the area to come and visit and see what they're going to do if they finance the dam and the destruction that will cause.
Nell Geiser from Boulder, Colorado.
How old are you?
16. Uh-huh. And we were arrested yesterday. We were taking part in a march to shut down the prison industrial complex. And there's about 700 people in the march, and we were walking and staying on the sidewalk, and it was a completely peaceful march. And the police stopped us at one point, and then we turned around and we're going to start marching back towards Connecticut. And then when we were marching through this small street or alleyway, the police blockaded us in both sides and wouldn't let us out, even though a lot of the people in there weren't protesters, just wanted to leave. And everyone was willing to disperse and to go out two by two, you know, if they would let us. And we were trying to leave when they blockaded us in. We were trying to stop the march. And then we were there for about 45 minutes to an hour, and then they started arresting us one by one. And
they put all the adults in school buses, and there's about 30 minors arrested and put in paddy wagons. We went to...
They separated you as minors?
Yeah.
They mean they ask each one your age?
Yeah. I guess if we looked young, they asked us our age. And then they, you know, they brought all the adults together. And then they brought us to a detention center and kept us there for about 4 hours. We got out about midnight last night. And they dropped all the charges against us. The charge was unlawful assembly. And I guess they figured since it was an unlawful arrest that they should probably drop the unlawful assembly charge.
Some of the sounds of the battle after Seattle, the protesters by more than 10,000 this past weekend, some estimate more than 20,000 in the streets of Washington, D.C., as well as a legal rally on the Ellipse behind the White House and in front of the Washington Monument. We're going to continue with these voices when we come back from our break here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we go back to the streets of Washington, D.C. this past weekend, where students, young activists, people of faith, farmers, teamsters, steelworkers, and other activists gathered in Washington over this past week calling for relief of the debt in developing countries, and this past weekend for closing of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. In addition to a rally of more than 10,000 people on Sunday attacking the World Bank and the IMF, thousands of people took to the streets, various intersections around the World Bank and the IMF, though the police had pushed out the perimeter to protect those buildings as the annual and semi-annual meetings were taking place. And the protesters tried to stop delegates from moving in. Police used tear gas, they clubbed people, but they also just stood at blockades as the protesters sat at the blockades, sometimes pushed the blockades forward. There were tense moments, and there were moments of jubilation when the police would move back after thousands would gather at a corner.
I don't think we did anything to deserve this. We've just been sitting here peacefully, and here they are putting on their gas masks.
I'm just standing at this line. The people in the front row, this is Witness for Peace, have just kneeled down. There are hundreds of people here in this corner, and now the police are moving in force, coming from both directions on Pennsylvania Avenue. We're quite near the White House, forming a line. They're putting their riot shields down. Dozens of police are moving in right now. You can hear whose streets are streets behind us, with people with all sorts of signs. There are a number of photographers here, people holding cameras, video cameras. As you heard, they're not allowing in the journalists either. Some journalists got press passes. I should say we didn't. The World Bank and IMF said they would not allow in happening right here as they give orders.
If they're coming in to arrest you, you can go limp with your body. Don't make it easy for them.
The police are moving in. They've got their riot batons out. They've got their shields. And behind them are police in riot gear. Even more police in riot gear. So you've got the police in the blue shirts, and behind that in totally in black. And people now are saying, Ohm. Can you tell us your name and why you're here and what you're expecting?
Yeah, my friends call me Penny. I don't even know really what I'm expecting right now.
Where are you from?
Oh, I'm from down south.
Where? And why are you here?
I'm here to protest the IMF and the World Bank.
The police have not given any warnings at this point. All the photographers are lining up behind, in front of the people. Behind them are the police. More and more police are coming in. Can you tell us why you're here today, where you're from?
I'm from Washington, D.C. I'm here to stop the World Bank from oppressing other people. Link for solidarity, link up all the struggles together to bring attention upon the oppression with, try to link up with people all across the world. All the people here in D.C. try to link up and fight oppression. The World Bank is putting on foreign people, going into their countries and destroying them. The World Bank comes in and gives them these high loans that they can't pay back.
Okay, this is the scene right now. We've got more than 100 police who are lined up. We've got a whole row of cameras and video cameras. A line of people mainly from Witness for Peace who have sat down in front of the police. Then there are a group of anarchists who are here, and the others have asked the anarchist banner to be put down, afraid that that will provoke the police. And behind that is the pig. This is the pig, the piggy bank that has flames under it, not actual flames, with people from Philadelphia ACT UP that are chained so they won't be able to move if anything happens. And then hundreds of people all around. And the protesters are chanting, film the cops, film the cops. They're saying, face the police, not us. Protesters understand from Seattle and other places that it is the cameras in some ways that will protect them. Again, the police are just standing right now, and the protesters, many of them have sat down, and it seems to be at this point a standoff. So the people are extremely peaceful. Many have red bandanas over their faces because they're afraid of tear gas, since tear gas has been used several times before. Can you tell me your name and why you're out here?
I'm Rebecca Ferris. I'm here because I care about justice in the world. I just returned from 2 years in Central America, and I saw the devastation that the IMF and the World Bank do to poor people there and around the world. Babies die every day because of the IMF and the World Bank, and I will not stand for that.
What are you doing?
We have vinegar on bandanas because it's going to help protect us from the tear gas, which hopefully they're not going to use. We've done nothing but sitting here peacefully and nonviolently since 5:30 this morning, so we hope that they do not use tear gas on us.
Smash the state, let's liberate, acknowledge me or go to hell, another friend to rebel. Stop, smash the state, let's liberate, acknowledge me or go to hell, another friend to rebel. Stop, smash the state, let's liberate, acknowledge me or go to hell, another friend to rebel. Stop.
SOA Watch is concerned with imperialism. We're concerned about the combination between globalization and militarization of the world, and that is exactly what IMF and World Bank's agenda is at this time.
Hello, Pacifica. Hello, world. What's going on, Pacifica?
Could you tell me what's going on here?
Well, all ahead, 12 more feet. Okay, all ahead. All ahead, stop. Right here. This is it, right here.
What is this right structure?
Here. This here is a Trojan cooling tower. The World Bank funds all kind of nuclear projects, and right here we have Michael Marriott, Nuclear Information Resource Service here. And we want the World Bank and the IMF never to fund any nuclear projects again. Simple as that. So this here is the Trojan nuke, okay? They always try and sneak nuclear power projects across the world. And right here we have Michael Marriott, who will tell you all about it, right there.
Hello, Michael. Tell me a little bit about what you're doing here today.
Well, we're just trying to point out that the World Bank, contrary to its policies, makes loans that enable the construction and operation of nuclear power plants, and the IMF is supporting continued operation of power plants, for example, in Bulgaria, the Kozloduy complex that the European Union is trying to close. Well, in the Czech Republic, for example, there's the Temelin nuclear complex, which is an old Soviet-designed reactor that's under construction. The World Bank has provided some loans that enable the Czech utility to divert its own money for the bank and that pay for electrical grid improvements to enable the a power plant of that size to be placed there. In Bulgaria, they have provided loans for various water diversion projects to enable flows of water into the plants and to enable Bulgaria to build a new reactor if it wants to. And in addition, in Bulgaria, the IMF went into the country recently, which Bulgaria's had some difficult economic times, and I'm not suggesting there shouldn't be loans to Bulgaria, but the IMF went into the country and talked about economic restructuring, said that, well, we need to keep these nuclear plants open. There's six plants there. Four of them don't even have containments. They don't meet any safety standards anywhere in the world. And the European Union has been trying for several years to close them. And it's a condition for Bulgaria's entry into the European Union is that these plants be closed. And here you have the IMF saying keep them open.
I think it's important to state things in a very visual fashion, and so this is the way you do it. This is a made out of old spools and old wood found behind an electronics store yesterday, and so we put it together, painted it up last night, and that's what we have right here, an old nuclear power plant that says the IMF and the World Bank should not fund anything nuclear in the future and get into good energy projects, not the bad energy projects that they fund now.
I see that you're all dolled up. You're in your tuxedo.
That's right, darling, because I think it's important to treat these demonstrations as formal events. So this is a formal demonstration, so I'm wearing my formal wear tonight. My top hat is at the cleaners, though.
What does your sign say?
My sign says Spank the Bank.
And it's, what does it look like?
The World Bank. It's a hand that's open palm to show that we're nonviolent individuals, and it's in red, yellow, and black.
I'm Adrian. I'm from Ecuador.
Why are you here?
I'm here because the people in my country are bored with a debt of $4,000 to the rich people of the World Bank and the IMF.
How much?
$4,000. Each children that's born is born with a debt of $4,000. And less than 5% of that is used to health and to education, to our health and to our education. So our people are maintained poor and ignorant, while most of the money they make is going to rich people, to the rich people of these institutions. So that's why I'm here, to protest against all that greed, you know? I mean, we're all equal, and we all deserve to have an opportunity, but down there in third world countries, we don't have that opportunity.
There's no meeting today!
There are no meetings today! The meeting
go home! Go
home! Go home! Go
home! Debt kills! Treat AIDS worldwide!
Sure, well, we built this tremendous Trojan horse, about 12 feet high, and it's kind of a symbol of what IMF loans are. We've got corporate shields here. I'm Walmart, we got McDonald's and Exxon and Nike, and what we're doing is we're walking down the street and jumping out of the horse. The reason that we're doing this is because, just like the Trojan horse, IMF loans are supposed to look like gifts to countries that are in debt, but in reality it's ways of kind of inserting our corporations into their economy and making them colonies for our economic system.
Save the Redwoods, boycott the Gap from California, San Francisco.
Could you describe the poster you have?
Donald Fisher, who owns the Gap, he owns controlling interests in Mendocino Redwood Company. Not only does he exploit child labor, but he also clear cuts a lot of Mendocino Redwood trees.
I got clubbed on the head by the police.
You did?
I sure did.
We were about an hour and a half ago. The police brought in some riot squad before this one came here, and the word came through that they were going to break the line to get some of the media through. They grabbed a man next to me, another protester, and started pulling him over. The guy next to me pulling over top of him, and then somebody grabbed him and tried to hold him back. And the next thing, the clubs started flying. So I got down on my knees, and as the police were dragging this protester right over the top of the guy next to me, and I got down, my face was only about a foot from the pavement, and I was just looking at the ground, and I looked up, saw the batons, they were starting to hit people around, and nudge people with them, and I just put my head down. Next thing I know, I got a direct blow right across the skull in the back of the head.
I'm a Teamster.
Teamster, and why are you here today?
To protest the actions of the IMF and the World Bank. They don't have any consideration, no democracy. They make decisions based on big money and not the majority.
As a Teamster, how does that hurt you?
It just lowers standards all over the world. We're concerned about every worker.
And what are you doing here right now? Describe for people on the radio what you're doing.
We've linked arms and we're blocking the street trying to keep the IMF delegates from getting through.
Have you been successful so far?
Yes.
How many people have tried to stop through and come through?
No. Ten.
Ten people?
Yeah.
And what happened to them?
Well, one of them got really irate and began sweating rather profusely and tried to force his way through. And a number of people have tried to do that too. And sorry, nobody gets through today. No work today. Everybody has to take the day off.
What group are you with?
I'm a Teamster too.
Thank you very much. Where did you come from today to be here today?
Vermont.
Our streets! Our streets! Our streets!
Yeah, I used to really not have a clue about what this country, you know, was really all about. But then I went and worked in Nicaragua in the 1980s with a group called Witness for Peace and saw how U.S. policy there was funding to overthrow.
And you've been listening to The Battle After Seattle, the sounds of the streets of Washington, D.C. this past weekend, produced with Maria Carrion. And if you'd like to order a cassette copy, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. There were more than 1,000 arrests as somewhere between 15 and 20,000 people took to the streets this weekend. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Errol Maitland's our technical director. Matthew Finch is our engineer. Special thanks to Donna Neiman and Bob Daughtry. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
We like to think that there's a little piece of us in everyone.
We are just looking for a place to survive.
Poverty.